the method in which the committee will operate. Mr. Lance will be given full and ample opportunity to answer each and every allegation that has been made during these past months. Mr. Lance will be treated with the utmost courtesy and consideration. His statement should be made without interruption by members of the committee. We don't intend this to be a trial by ordeal. We will be in session this morning from 10 to 12. We will resume at 2 until 5. We will come in tomorrow morning, if necessary, at 10 to 12, resume at 2, and then go to 5. At 5 o'clock, I will poll the committee and also request of Mr. Lance whether we can finish in a reasonable period of time. If it looks there are still many questions to be asked, we will go over until Saturday. We will resume Saturday at 10 and go to 12, and hopefully we can finish Saturday afternoon. With that, is there any comment from any member of the committee? Senator Roth?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to make a statement at this time. Let me open by quoting our president. The confidence of people in our own government must be restored. But too many officials do not deserve that confidence. There is a simple and effective way for public officials to regain public trust, be trustworthy. I agree with these words, and I believe that they help to put these hearings into the proper perspective. Now, this is not a court of law. We are not here to determine Mr. Lance's guilt or innocence regarding any violation of law. In mine, we are here to answer two basic questions. Is Burt Lance qualified to be the director of OMB? Does he meet the ethical standards the public has a right to expect from its public officials and for which the president has called? Second, why did this committee not receive all the information it needed to evaluate Mr. Lance's qualifications, the time of his confirmation, and who was responsible? These questions must be asked and must be fully answered to restore public confidence. Mr. Lance is appearing for a third time before this committee at his own request and at the date he requested. This committee wants to give him every opportunity to answer the allegations that have been raised. But I think it's only fair to say to you, Mr. Lance, that based on the evidence of record, the burden of proof has shifted to you to show that your actions are consistent with the president's high ethical standards, the standards expected of a person in a position of high public trust. The evidence shows a pattern of massive overdrafts to Mr. Lance and his family. The controller of the currency is characterized as unusual, improper, and inconsistent with sound banking practices. The evidence shows that Mr. Lance uses Calhoun Bank to support his political campaign for governor, charges that were referred to the Department of Justice for possible criminal prosecution. The evidence shows a curious shifting of the correspondent accounts of Mr. Lance's banks to parallel personal loans to Mr. Lance. The evidence shows that corporate bank aircraft were used for questionable political and personal purposes. The evidence shows that information this committee needed was known to the Office of the Controller of the Currency, the Department of Justice, according to a recent statement by President Carter's press secretary, high White House officials. This admission raises a central question: what did they know? When did they know it? And what did they do about it? I want to restate, as I did when these hearings began, that this committee has no power to remove Mr. Lance from office. That decision rests with the president, who must determine whether Mr. Lance is the kind of leader who will restore faith in our government, the kind of leader who, in the president's word, is honorable and competent and deserving of our trust. For as the president has said, if we cannot believe that, Little else matters. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chairman, I do not believe any of our members have statements. We'll wait to hear from Mr. Lance.
Are there any other statements on this, sir? You may proceed, Mr. Lance.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
I think it required to be sworn. You soundly swear that the testimony you'll give before this committee will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, the whole thing. Thank you.
Before you start, may I ask a rule about, ask the chair to rule on the cameras and whether we're going to have free reign here, or are they going to be between us and Mr. Lance, or are we going to have any rule in that regard?
I would say that the request of any member of the committee that the cameras in front of the witness interfere with the witness or the members of the Senate, I will ask the cameras in front to leave.
I think at some point, I think they ought to get all the pictures they want, but at some point I think there ought not be a substantial number of people between the witness and the senators who are hearing.
I think the request is fair, and I would respectfully request that the cameras will have 2 minutes to take their pictures and please leave in front of Mr. Lance. And may I state that we will proceed in the usual order. Each member will have 15 minutes to question. And after the first round, we will then go back again and continue that way for 15 minutes on behalf of each member of the committee.
Tom, the photographers are still clicking away. Those, of course, are the still cameras. And as the chairman said, they're going to have a couple of minutes. It looks as though Bert Lance there has quite an entourage with him, does he? Apart from Clark Clifford, who's just in front of you, his family's there, too?
He does have his family, Frank, his friends, his attorneys, and he has been all morning a man who has been smiling very broadly. He has been a man who has shown very little of the tension that obviously has built up over a matter of the past few weeks as he's tried to deal with this matter. And in his statement, he answers some of the statements that have been made against him. He, at one point, says that his bank had no specific guidelines, for example, for the use of the aircraft that he is alleged to have used for his private use.
He knows he's in for a rough time, though, because just that opening statement by Senator Roth has quite a bite to it.
It does, and it will be very interesting to see how, during the course of the day and during the course of these hearings, he is able to answer those specific charges. Senator Roth making the point that, one, did Bert Lance live up to the high ethical standards of Jimmy Carter, and two, did he attempt to deceive the committee in his earlier testimony? Those seem to be the main points around which this testimony and this hearing will pivot.
A member of the staff tells me that he has a back condition that requires him to be home today, and that is why he is not on the dais. You may proceed, Mr. Lance.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm here today not only to make this statement and to answer any questions you may have, but also to speak directly to the American people. Many charges and accusations involving me have been brought to their attention until I'm sure they really wonder what kind of man I am. They'll know me much better when I have finished testifying before this committee, because I intend to answer every charge that has been made, and I shall answer every question that is asked to the best of my ability. I have infinite faith in the fairness of the American people. I welcome them as the jury in this proceeding, for I am secure and comfortable knowing that my conscience is clear and that the people's verdict will be a fair and just one. I believe it would be of value if I spoke briefly of my background and training. I was born in Gainesville, Georgia on June the 3rd, 1931. My father was the president of Young Harris College in the mountains of northeast Georgia. When I was a boy, we moved to Calhoun, Georgia, where my father became superintendent of the city school system. In Calhoun, I started working at an early age. I delivered special delivery letters for the post office, worked at a local grocery store, and after school each day had a job at the local theater. I came to know the people of Calhoun. I went to Emory University and later to the University of Georgia, but left college to take a job at the Calhoun First National Bank in 1952 to support my wife and new son. I started in the bank as a teller at $90 a month. By 1958, my wife and I pooled our resources and bought our first stock in the Calhoun National Bank. In 1963, at age 32, I was elected president of the bank. In 1966, I met President Carter and became a friend of his. I supported him both times he ran for governor, and after he was elected, I accepted the position of director of the State Highway Department. I'm proud of the progress that was made in that department. I believe it ranks today with the best in the country. When I assumed the directorship of the department, it was the largest and most controversial department in Georgia state government. Working closely with the people in the department, we made important changes. For the first time in Georgia history, roads were allocated on the basis of real need rather than political considerations. We were able to improve the quality of service to the people of Georgia, while at the same time we substantially reduced the number of employees. In 1974, I ran for governor of Georgia. I gave it everything I had, and I missed the crucial runoff by about 1%. In December of 1974, I was offered the position of the president of the National Bank of Georgia. I accepted it because I felt that I had reached a point in my career where, through my intimate knowledge of the state and the numerous contacts I had made, I could make a unique contribution to the growth and standing of the bank, as well as to the economic development of the state. Much has been said in the press recently about my management of the Calhoun Bank and the National Bank of Georgia. Let me recite some facts which have not been brought to the attention of the public. During the period I served as president and chairman of the Calhoun Bank, its deposits increased from $11 million to $49 million. Its assets increased from $11.9 million to $54.1 million. At the National Bank of Georgia, the results were more dramatic. In the 2 years of 1975 and 1976, its deposits increased 50%, and its assets increased from $254 million to $404 million. Because of the volume of unfavorable publicity these past weeks, it may come as a surprise when I say that no depositor in either the Calhoun Bank or the National Bank of Georgia ever lost a cent while I was with those banks. In addition, I have read many critical stories devoted to family loans and overdrafts. I want you to know and understand that every overdraft has been paid in full. From January 1975 to the end of 1976, I served as the president of the National Bank of Georgia. Following the election, President-elect Carter asked me to serve in his new administration as director of the Office of Management and Budget. In January of 1977, I was confirmed by this committee and the Senate. Then in late May, the questions began and gradually grew into a full-fledged investigation. Now today, after weeks of accusations,